WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Think about the women in your life. Maybe you have a matriarchal grandmother, a doting mother, maybe a cool, chatty aunt, a street-smart sister. Well, one thing these women have in common is that they're all subjected to stereotypes that some people have of women, especially Black and brown women, and the role they play in our lives. But women are more than these flattening archetypes. We invited author Prisca Dorcas Mojica Rodriguez to discuss her latest book. It's called Tias and Primas, on knowing and loving the women who raise us. And it aims to explore and expand what it means to be a Latina and break down those boxes. She calls it a love letter to family, community, and Latinas everywhere. So I began by asking her why she felt this follow-up to her first book, For Brown Girls with Sharp Edges and Tender Hearts, was needed.
For a lot of reasons. I think the first one was very autobiographical. And I just talked about me. And then I realized it was really hanging out with one of my good friends who I grew up with, who has similar family dynamics to mine, because mm-hmm. I know them, who was like, wow, I'm so sorry you went through all that. But I was like, wait, did you miss the part where it's supposed to be like a mirror and like you're supposed to think about the ways that maybe your family can be similar? Like, I was just like, wait, did you just think? Because yeah. Her reflection was, oh my God, your dad sounds awful. And I was like, wait, I know your dad and he's not a saint. So if your conclusion is just to criticize my family, then I think you missed the thesis. So I was like, okay, let me write something that feels more direct. Like, okay, I can say all these things that impacted me, but now, no, they impact all of us. Mm-hmm. And this book is a lot more prescriptive. It's a lot about other women in our family that kind of move in different ways because of sexism, because of systemic things. But it is really like turning the mirror around more overtly than the first one did.
To that end, in the intro of this book, you talk about how Latinas are grouped into one of three stereotypical categories. So talk more about that. What are the categories you mention?
Yeah, it's the spicy, sexy Latina. You know, wearing red. I think Sofia Vergara was placed to play that even pretty recently, right? Mm-hmm. The maid, like the subservient, like service worker, or the chola, chonga, which is like the more gang affiliated, not very smart. And you would think we'd moved away from this, but it was really I think Selena Gomez did an SNL skit, I want to say 2022, early 2022. Mm-hmm. She was on SNL and there was a skit of her playing a chola with the only other Latina that SNL has ever had.
I got a new eyeliner.
I was going to say, I saw that. Yeah. It looks good.
Yeah, but the eyeliner poked me in the eye.
Oh.
It was that I was like, wait, this is still happening? Y'all are still putting us in just these very limiting categories. You have this Latina who's a guest, and you have your only SNL Latina who's like on staff, and this is where you went
playing
again.
A very stereotypical part.
Yeah, I was like, we haven't evolved. It's 2022. So it was at a response to that, realizing, oh, y'all don't understand how vast, how complex, how funny, how wicked, how brilliant we are. So I'll write it.
Yeah. What do you think that says to you then about how American media and even perhaps the wider population of people views Latinas in general?
I think it's the ways that they continue to dehumanize us. And it's like, you know, the anti-immigrant policies, the way that, was it Ana DuVernay? Like, she got a pass from ICE to go do Dancing with the Stars, but people can't come see their families get hit, buried, or, you know, like come to funerals. Like, the ways that we face the negative effects of anti-immigration rhetoric, the ways that we're profiled, it translates to so many bigger things, right, when we're seeing through this very dehumanized white lens that has no context for this, like, lacks creativity for how much more we are.
So how does one begin to break these stereotypes? I mean, you talked a moment ago about, I'll write it. You said, I will write the book about it. Is that one way?
Yeah, I think that's one way. I'm also very adamant in the book that, like, I've got limits. Like, I can't write for all of Latinidad. So these are just the 20 that I could come up with, but I know I'm missing some. So what am I missing? Like, I want people to think harder and think deeper, because I live in Nashville, Tennessee. And when the stereotypes and the tropes, I find myself absorbing them. I remember one time I even said to one of my friends, because, like, I got dismissed in a class for something, and I was walking my friend out of the class, and she was like, you should be upset about this. And I was like, no, it's because I'm spicy. I'm too much. People don't get it. And she's like, no, that's really weird. Like, you're not a condiment. Like, stop absorbing how white people see you. So it was like, we begin to absorb these tropes if we don't have alternative storylines and alternative people in the mainstream saying a counter story.
Now, before we dig into some specifics here, like you said, you explore 20 different archetypes of particularly Latina women, you know, the la prima perfecta, the young tía, widow tía, the childless tía. I mean, how did you come up with this list, and how did you narrow it down to 20?
It was a lot of listening and a lot of tuning in and a lot of, I call it, like, writing a book is just turning to the right dial. Like, it's a lot of static for me. There's so much information that I'm constantly dealing with and I'm trying to navigate, but then the book sold and it was like, all right, tune in. And so I just, like, put screens away, and I actually went to Mexico and was there for 2 weeks because I couldn't go back to my country. So it was, Mexico was where I was going to go. And I just, like, walked around the streets and, like, went to stores and just talked to señoras and women and was just like, oh yeah, this is it. Just paying attention and being in Nashville, Tennessee, you do have to go to very specific places to seek Latina community. And so it was like just tuning in and becoming more aware.
And you base some on women in your own life, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's talk about some of these women, starting with the WhatsApp tía, because I have to say, as someone who's from the Caribbean, and my family, of course, is as well, this one resonated deeply with me. We're also known to obsess over this mobile app, especially the older women in our lives. So talk more about what you describe as this community organizer once family members migrate, and why you say that she should be protected at all costs.
Yeah, I do a lot of research because I like to base it on data, too, a lot of what I'm writing. And there wasn't a lot of articles written about WhatsApp other than, like, Latin American and Caribbean communities tend to use WhatsApp. It was kind of like there was nothing. And I was like, what does that mean? Because I know I have a cousin who, like, will meet you and be like, what's your WhatsApp? Like, that's her first thing if she likes you.
Yeah.
So I was just like, it feels so integral, especially to folks in the diaspora, in the ways that we communicate with our families, that I just was like, I'll bring her to life. I know what she's like. I know what the emojis and the graphics she's sending me. I get them all the time. I just started scrolling through my WhatsApp and just seeing all the images. I was like, oh, this is, she's special and she's cool. And she is a community organizer because she is sort of gathering us all across the world at this point, just try to stay connected to us. And she feels so integral and not celebrated enough for yes. what she does bring to the families.
You dropped so many gems in this particular chapter. Here's one part that I really liked. You said, the WhatsApp Tia is attempting to reach beyond country lines and stay in your life. The WhatsApp Tia is trying, and her efforts will be felt when they are no longer present. The WhatsApp Tia is a treasure, or rather, she carries treasured memories of your life with her, and she will share those treasures with you as often as she is able. She's like a rope waiting for you when you're in need of her assistance, when the world feels hard and the obstacles feel plentiful. She's waiting. That is so true. I'm thinking of aunts of mine right now. I woke up to messages from several aunts all on WhatsApp. And it's just become the norm. It's the way I don't know my day or how to function without waking up to those messages.
Yeah. And like understanding the app, like people don't have it on their phones. Yes. I'm always shocked. I'm like, what do you mean? Or people will be like, I don't know how to use it. My notifications aren't on. I'm like, what do you mean?
Right.
How is this not just as important as any other messaging app that you're using? It is like that. Oh, you don't know what it's like to have family that maybe doesn't have iPhones mm-hmm. and isn't live, in the United States.
Doesn't live in the United States. That's the key. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Priska, you also write about the so-called pretty prima. And you mentioned in this chapter, you said, I've never seen this archetype written about before. You also admit that not every Latin American family has a pretty prima or one that exists to the extreme that you describe in the chapter. So I'm curious what message you are trying to send with this one.
I think it's a note on like the over glorification of whiteness that happens in non-Black Latina spaces. It's also like the ways that we can place value on external beauty. And I've seen it. I've seen households that operate like this that are very much, she's really pretty. Mm-hmm. My daughter's pretty. And here's my house, but my daughter's really pretty. So like this overemphasis on this like beautiful daughter. Yes. And I remember like the suffocating way that I interacted with this prima. It was a chapter that was actually really hard for me to write because as somebody who can look more indigenous, I was not this prima. Mm-hmm. I only saw this prima living, and I found even like some anger and resentment that I had towards this prima. And so much of the work in these chapters is like, no, ultimately there are systems in place. Mm. That hurt this person too.
Yeah.
That make this person think that their value then is only related to their external beauty. So what happens when they age and inevitably might not always look like they looked at their prime, quote unquote.
Yeah.
So it is deconstructing the ways that each of these archetypes are dealing with different systems of oppression and the ways that they're responding to it, surviving it, and maybe failing.
You're digging into colorism. And yeah. colonization, all in one very powerful chapter, I find.
Yeah. Yeah.
You open the book with the matriarch, and you introduce readers to your late grandmother, Rosa Esperanza. What do you think were her most important qualities?
It's all the critique that I then have about it later, the hyper-importance, the dependability. She was just always there. She never dropped the ball. She never forgot anybody. She's like sometimes who I wish to be when I don't text back that friend or forget that I owe somebody a phone call or whatever. But I'm just like busy living, trying to feed myself. And I drop the ball all the time. She just never did. She like it felt like she never could. Like it was impossible to be as perfect as she was. She just like knew who needed the most tenderness, who needed the most attention, knew where to shift her focus, but never away from someone else, mm-hmm. just to expand it to other people. It was magical. She just felt magical and scarily perfect.
Mm, yeah, scarily.
Yeah.
Are there qualities of your matriarch that you think families can sometimes take for granted?
Yeah.
Or that we don't recognize until they've left us?
I think we took her for granted. I know my grandpa took her for granted. I think we all thought she was always going to be around. And that was it was catastrophic when she passed so young, because
she was only in her 50s, right?
Yeah. And to have her pass as young as she did, it was sort of like, wait, we've had this, I say it in the book, we've had this like strong tree with like thick roots that sort of held all of us together. And then the tree was gone, and we didn't know how much her presence meant to everything, how much her home was warm because she made it warm. Like it changed everything. It just felt dark immediately, and it was like a crater left behind. Mm-hmm. And I think that was like the her demise. That was why she died. She didn't take care of herself because she was busy not dropping the ball for everyone else. And so it is a lot of like that's a problem. We contributed to this, her early passing, and we should check that, and we should think about that before it's too late.
These archetypes that we're talking about, I mean, where do you think they came from? I mean, as women, do we develop into these types of beings, or are we forced into these categories?
I think it's like trauma, but it's trauma. It's a very specific, very invisible way that women and girls are raised in the expectations that are placed. Like, I very much fall into the oldest daughter category, but I'm not the oldest child. I had an older brother, mm-hmm. but he didn't have to step into roles that I had to step into because I was a woman. I was expected to have more capacity for, you know, tenderness and nurturing and leadership. And I was just expected to be a manager of the house, mm-hmm. while he just got to exist. So I do think it's a very particular way that women are raised and expected. Women of color specifically are raised and expected to hold more, mm-hmm. and to keep everything going.
So what do you want readers to walk away with from this book?
Conversations. It's a drop in a bucket. It's just some stories with a lot of theory, but ultimately, like, what did your matriarch feel like? What did your tia who saw fantasmas feel like? Mm-hmm. How is it the same? How is it different? I just want people to talk, because I do believe that there's a lot of secrets. I think, especially in my household, women were tasked with keeping secrets and keeping our feelings to ourselves, mm. and our anger to ourselves. And
ooh, I feel that.
Just like, yeah, I really, really want us to get out of these secret lives and just have these conversations out in the open, because I think everybody will be better for it.
Mm-hmm. What did you learn about yourself, Prisca, through this work of, you know, dissecting into these stereotypes, but also digging so deep into your family's history?
I found places where I still haven't grieved enough, maybe. I found rage in some chapters. Tu tia la loca. There was a lot of rage in that for me. As somebody who's called la loca in my family, as somebody whose family, they don't acknowledge my career because I'm saying too many things I'm not supposed to be saying. Mm. And so it's very dismissively like, es loca, no le pongas atención. And so that, like, I found a lot of feelings and a lot of sadness and a lot of also just, I felt sad for my grandma. I felt sad. I just, there was a lot of feelings I was sorting through as I was writing it. And there was the first draft, second draft, maybe up to the fifth draft. A lot of these, I was like, ooh, to rock. You need to hold this close and wait till you figure some of this stuff out before you continue writing this chapter. But it was necessary, the journey, because I did want to, our stories don't get told and don't get centered, and people just like get forgotten if we don't bring them back to life through stories. So I felt it was important to keep these people alive.
Well, you've only just release this one, but I have to ask, given what you just shared, I mean, do you think there's room for you to write another book?
Yeah, I just finished the novel.
Oh, wow.
So it's going through editing stages, but yeah, I'm a big believer that this stuff is important and this messaging is important, and repackaging it as much as possible to get as many readers as possible is important also. So I'm ready for a novel. A young adult novel is the goal.
But first, we celebrate the release of Tias and Primas on Knowing and Loving the Women Who Raise Us. It's out now and it's available wherever books are sold. Thank you to author Prisca Dorcas Mojica Rodriguez. We appreciate you joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced and mixed by Micah Yasin. It was edited by Dan Tucker. You can support the work we do on Reset by liking and subscribing to our podcast. We drop new episodes every weekday with a special one on Saturday. You can also sign up for our newsletter. Head to wbez.org/resetnews. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for listening.
My name is Donald. I live on the southeast side of Chicago. I support WBEZ because of the balanced reporting and covering so much about an issue as opposed to just the few seconds that you may hear on most other news outlets. It matters to me to hear the story more completely